Hello there, welcome to this week's edition of The Front Page, and we are going to be looking back on dramatic weeks at Goodwood and Galway, which included a big race DQ at Galway and a 150-1 shock success in the Sussex Stakes. Also, a big shock last week was the announcement of the closure with immediate effect of Thurles Racecourse in Ireland. Talking about that with me, Lee Mottershead, are my Racing Post colleagues, Lewis Porteous. Good morning, Lewis.
Morning, Lee.
And at home in York, Matt Rennie. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning to you guys down in London.
Matt will be limbering, looking forward now to the York Ebor Festival, which is just 2 weeks away. But we've just had one of British racing's big summer festivals, which took place last week from Tuesday to Saturday at Goodwood. And my goodness, there was plenty to talk about. The meeting is highlighted by the Qatar-sponsored Sussex Stakes, one of the great mile races in the Group 1 calendar, and it was supposed to mark the continued progression towards legendary status of Field of Gold, who was so dazzling in the Irish 2000 Guineas and the St James's Palace Stakes. But in a very unusual sort of race, he flopped, finishing fourth behind his pacemaker Kirat, who, brilliantly ridden by Richard Kingscote, made much of the running to win for trainer Rafe Beckett at odds of 150-1, from Rosalian in second, Henri Matisse in third, and back in fourth, Field of Gold, who, it was revealed the following day, was slightly lame. Lewis, you were doing the big race report on the Sussex. I don't imagine that when you were thinking about potential intros in the morning, Kirat was going to figure prominently.
Nah, came as a shock to everyone on course. There was a real sense of what the heck just happened after he crossed the line, who, what and how. I didn't see it coming. He was obviously in there as to set the fractions for the favourite, Field of Gold. What I found quite revealing afterwards was Richard Kingscote actually said he'd even had a chat with John Gosden and William Bewick prior to it, and they knew that he was going to set even fractions rather than go flat out, yet they still seemed to largely ignore him, which that's a bit that baffled me a little bit afterwards, Lee, that he's there to set honest fractions but not go too fast, so you'd think you'd be two or three away from him ready to strike, but not just Will Bewick, the rest of the field gave the two front runners too much rope, and Kirat, who got an incredible record at the course, unbeaten record at the course, didn't stop, did he? But like I say, the thing that I took out was just the pure shock, and amongst the crowd they couldn't really fathom what had happened, and you go there to witness a champion, and you come away with the biggest prize winner of a Group 1 in Britain ever.
Yeah, it was a weird one, Matt, because as Lewis says, it wasn't as though Kirat went like the clappers from the front, so much so that Henri Matisse's pacemaker Serengeti, who'd missed the kick, was rushed up and went by Kirat quite easily. Kirat then got a toe into the race from Henri Matisse's pacemaker without ever really looking like he was in much trouble. I mean, he was travelling well all the way up the home straight, Kirat. Sean Levy on the second Rosalian has said that he should have won and they'd given the horse too much to do, and the same would seemingly apply to the third and fourth. It was a bizarre one.
Yeah, it was a bit of a mess of a race, really, on paper. But could you not now say that the mile division, three-year-old and older horses, in a bit of a mess as well? I know before the race we were saying how much better the three-year-olds are going to be. There goes a 151 older horse winner, and Rosalian finishes ahead of Henri Matisse and Field of Gold quite comprehensively. So it does leave a lot of good storylines for the rest of the season. But you were looking at that when they were 3.5, 4 furlongs to go, thinking, hang on here, those two pacemakers, I know they were thinking they're pacemakers, but they were out in front and going quite well. I mean, a big word for Richard Kingscote. He's probably the only one jockey in the race that got the tactics spot on timings-wise. And it shows just how much a huge loss he's going to be to our jockey ranks in Britain, given he's won two Group 1s now since he's announced he's going to be having a stint in Hong Kong. Look, it's a race that still has more questions than answers, and I think the questions aren't going to get the answers. I think the one thing we can categorically say now is that Field of Gold, we knew he's never going to be a patch on Frankel, but he's never a patch on Baid either. I think we forget how good Baid was all those years. Well, not even all those years ago, three or 4 years ago now, which is a shame. But there's still plenty to go out in the Marlin division for the rest of the season. Some nice narratives to go after.
Yeah, there are. Lewis, take on board what Matt just said there, but I guess if Field of Gold did have a genuine excuse and they reported he was lame on his left hind, he can be forgiven that run. I mean, he's got to be better than he showed there. I mean, the winner, Kirat, has run to a Racing Post rating of 114, which is not the sort of level you expect a Sussex Stakes to be won at. So it'd be interesting what they do with Field of Gold once he comes back, and also what they do with Kirat. Because of it, he was 27th in the Royal Hunt Cup on his previous start.
Yeah.
But he's not going to go back to handicaps after he's reassessed now. They're talking about maybe an international campaign, and I guess, you know, he's a gelding. They can just have a lot of fun with it.
Oh, absolutely. They can have as many free hits as they want, really. You could, you'd love to see him globe trotting. I think that would be a good fit for him. He's still in that Clipper handicap, isn't he, at York?
They cut him for that after a race.
Eights from 20s.
Yeah. Interesting market.
Could be a big price. Yeah, I think it's a bit too early to be sort of saying Field of Gold is, you know, not the horse we thought he was and things like that. He's shown brilliance at times, and it was one bad performance, and that was a combination of A, the tactics. I don't think even if he'd have been at his best, it'd have been a big ask to pick the leader up from where he came from, and B, this lameness has come to light. So there is an excuse. Hopefully it's not a serious issue that keeps him out for a while. And I still like the prospect of seeing him over 10 furlongs down the line,
yeah,
where they can sit, and then use his incredible sort of burst of pace. So I think it's too early to be sort of saying, why can't he still be a superstar? You know what I mean? They aren't machines. They are allowed a bad, an off day, and I can see him. He'll bounce back in the future. I'm sure he will.
Yeah, and what's interesting fact too from Wednesday was that two of the grandchildren of the late Prince Khalid Abdullah were at Goodwood to see the race. Obviously, they didn't see the race they quite expected to witness, but further evidence there of real interest and engagement in the sport from the family of the late Judmont founder, which clearly is important to that operation, but also to the wider racing industry. Matt, question for you. Did it rain in York on Thursday?
No, it was actually gloriously sunny when I was watching the racing.
Was it raining? Sure.
We've got it today on Monday. We've had the delay of 5 hours, okay. five days, well, but it's now absolutely diabolical, and I feel sorry for what you guys went through down there on Thursday.
Oh, and we did go through it. Didn't we go through it, Lewis? Wasn't it wet on Thursday?
Drowned rats, weren't we?
Drowned rats, yeah. It absolutely hammered down. Really kicked in during the Richmond Stakes on Thursday, after which I remember walking out through the hall that separates the racecourse side from the paddock side, and getting to the point where I was supposed to step outside and looking at that thinking, good races at Richmond Stakes, but I'm not going to get completely soaked to speak to connections. Clive Cox was a braver man. His suit must have been ruined as he went to greet his Richmond Stakes winner. The lightning then kicked in, which meant the next two races were started by tape. One of those races was the Nassau Stakes, and Lewis, Whirl was very, very good indeed, and she's becoming an ever more impressive racehorse. But there was a bit of controversy afterwards when people looked back at the start, and it was very raggy with the five fillies starting in different places. Ryan Moore saying afterwards the race was pretty much run at the start. Equally though, Tom Marquand was saying after the Gordon Stakes, she won the race before, that none of us wanted to get into a big metal toaster, giant toaster. So you can see why they absolutely had to start the race by tape. Should they have waited? Should they have given a bit more time to see if the conditions improved? Or knowing that there was an ITV window they had to fit in, was their hand forced?
Yeah, I mean, how long's a piece of string? Yeah. How long was this storm going to last for? How long was... We weren't expecting that amount. That's how unpredictable the weather is. We all know that. I think Goodwood and British Racing got some stick for that, but only a fool would have put them into the starting stalls. Yeah. It's just not a risk worth taking. They were down at the start. You can't keep waiting and waiting and waiting. You certainly can't bring them back. I have absolutely no issue with the decision to flag start it. I think where we can work on is the process of that flag start, because clearly it was ragged.
Yeah.
Will got away quickly, and an uncomplicated filly like that, you are gifting her an advantage. But like I say, I have no issue with a flag start, and it's something they probably do once in a blue moon, don't they? So
yeah.
it's hard for the starter as well. So I do have sympathy, but it's a group one, so we want it a level playing field as possible. But in those circumstances, which were, it wasn't just rain, it was biblical, and there was thunder, there was lightning, they need to get the race run, and they need to keep everyone safe. So the flag start was the right call.
Yeah, I agree. Matt, how impressed are you with World? Do you see her as an arc winner?
Yeah, I do. It's the simple answer. Even sort of taking a pinch of salt with how the Nassau was run, she's getting more and more impressive each time. She was really, really good in the Musidora Stakes up in York at the Dante meeting, but it's still the last day's win in the penultimate day's win in the Pretty Polly, beating Kalpana, which does it for me, and I can't see how she's not a fair bit shorter than Kalpana in the betting for the arc, given what Kalpana did. She ran an absolute stormer in the King George last weekend. I'd be begging Coolmore and Aidan O'Brien to supplement her whenever they can for it. I guess the caution is that Aidan and O'Brien and Coolmore haven't really sent their huge guns for any tilts at the arc recently. You think back to Auguste Rodin, missed out to go to the Breeders' Cup. City of Troy obviously had a go at the Breeders' Cup Classic as well last year. So I'll be holding on to that. But the fact we've seen she can do it, and do it mightily impressively in bottomless ground, which, given the location of Longchamp on the banks of the River Seine, it gets bottomless there very, very quickly. And we've seen arcs are regularly run on that type of ground. And now she's got almost a bomb-proof profile for that type of race. And I just love her as a horse as well, because she's already shown she's so tough. I mean, it's A squared, B squared, if she thought she should have won the Oaks or not, but she definitely stays the mile and a half. And she very much reminds me of maybe an even more impressive version than Found, obviously one of Aidan's last arc winners, and she was a tough-as-teak filly and mare. I think World probably much better than her, so she's my number one contender for the arc, for sure.
Yeah, mine would be Kalpana. Lewis, I actually think Kalpana will reverse the form. I thought she ran a cracking race at Ascot on softer ground. I think she'd be a real force. You got any early arc takes?
I tell you what, I'd love to see a World Mini Hawk rematch. Yeah. Just anywhere. I just think, like, they're just two very uncomplicated fillies. And you think of Found, Minding, Magical, all these. It's just a long list, isn't it? Yeah. It goes on. They're so uncomplicated. Whether it be in the arc or whatever, I would love to see that. I've got a particular soft spot for Mini Hawk, I must admit.
Okay, well, we might well see Mini Hawk at York and the Yorkshire Oaks, with Aidan sort of indicating last week that Will might be kept back for an arc trial somewhere else. Aidan O'Brien was also celebrating on Tuesday, albeit celebrations were tempered when we discovered the news that Trushan had lost his life in a Goodwood Cup that was won by Scandinavia, who beat his stable companion Illinois. Illinois had started favourite, had been the pick of Ryan Moore, but Scandinavia, who was so impressive in the Bahrain Trophy on his previous outing, in the end overhauled Illinois and marched towards clear favouritism for the St Ledger. Lewis, it was an excellent performance by Scandinavia, who does look the one to beat in the Ledger. Illinois frustrated yet again in a Group 1, but really the biggest headlines in the race were very sad headlines, with the death of a great warrior in Trushan.
Ah, it's tragic, wasn't it? He's been a great friend to racing, great warrior, certainly didn't deserve that, but it was just one of those tragic incidents that happens, and it just leaves you completely deflated, doesn't it? It was very sad. Aidan O'Brien spoke well, I thought, afterwards. And I was speaking to Alan King down there on Saturday. I think when we spoke to him midweek, they'd had about 200 emails. He said they'd had 400 emails now. And he said on Saturday the letters were starting to arrive now. So just what a horse to take our, you know, our sport beyond just horses running around a field. This was a horse that had a massive following. We loved him. He was around for years. And you've got to remember, though, he was quite lightly raised for an older horse.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
The
amount of times he went to the Gold Cup and turned up at Ascot and never actually ran. So he was looked after. It was just, a tragic end to a fantastic career.
In the big sprints on Friday and Saturday, Lewisham was there Friday, Saturday as well. James Jungle won the King George Stakes. Two Tribes won the Stewards Cup, completing a big handicap double on consecutive weekends. Both excellent performances. Those, anything else that particularly took your eye during the week?
Big kudos to Richard Spencer. Like, he had the first, fourth and fifth in the Stewards Cup. That's an incredible achievement. And His stable's really hit form, and it just came out afterwards how ambitious they are. You know, you don't speak to some of these people don't always get the spotlight, but he's clearly an ambitious young trainer, and he's got a great backer in Phil Cunningham, who's an enthusiast. You know, I think it was good for the sport to showcase other people, and Phil's put obviously an enormous amount of money into racing, so they're getting their just rewards really. And then the Quins, you never write them off, can you?
No.
They're just what a fantastic outfit. Just get tough horses, hardy horses that come back time and time again. Like James Jungle's record, I know a lot of it's been in handicaps up to Friday, but his record's incredible of when he just hitting the frame every time. And it advertised the lack of maybe strength and depth in the sprint division, but that makes it an open division, and
yeah,
that can be fun in its own right.
Yeah, it can't be vintage all the time. Matt Rennie is actually off to see the Quins this week for an interview that will appear in the Racing Post as part of our build-up to the Ebor Festival. Matt, I'm sure you also had your eyes on Galway during the week. The biggest news there, the biggest headlines there, were made in relation to the Galway hurdle on Thursday when we had the DQ of the first past the post Helvic Dream, and Darwi was promoted to first place. David Jennings wrote a very interesting column in Saturday's Racing Post, which you can get digitally, in which he welcomed what he saw as a rare example of Irish stewards chucking out a winner who deserved to be demoted. Matt, did you agree that Helvic Dream deserved to be thrown out?
Yes, unfortunately so. I was actually doing we do quick reports, obviously, to get something quickly on the site. And I was watching it, and I was speaking to a couple of our colleagues and said, well, I might have to do another take of this, because I thought, I felt really sorry for Don Armila, but he should have switched his whip earlier on into the other hand. And he was leaning on Ndarwi the whole way. And it's just one of them where everything pointed towards, unfortunately, it needs to be reversed. And I think kudos to the stewards as well. I agree with Mr. Jennings that, you know, they did it right. It took about 15-20 minutes after the race, but to be fair to them, in the coverage, especially on Racing TV, they had the cameras on Noel Mead and Gordon Elliott, and it actually added to the occasion and the drama, and I thought they did really well with that. And I think the stewards did really well to come up with a decision on the day. They took their time, I think rightly so, to make the right call. Unfortunately, it was a thrilling race, but it was definitely the right call. Had Donna switched his whip into his other hand, you know, a furlong out, we might have been saying, oh, it's a great ride and much deserved on the Helvic Dream. But yeah, very much the right call, but added a bit of extra spice to one of Ireland's biggest hurdle races, that's for sure.
Yeah, it did. There was a big crowd watching that race, and a big crowd at Goodwood throughout the week. They reported at the end of the glorious meeting that attendances in public enclosures were up around 10% year on year, which is excellent news for Goodwood. But there was really devastating news in relation to one Irish racecourse last week. We'll be talking about that and what it might mean for other racecourses in Ireland and Britain after this break. Welcome back to the front page. And as we said, going into the break, there was very bad news indeed for Irish racing in relation to Thurles Racecourse, whose closure with immediate effect was announced on Saturday morning. Thurles is really part of the integral grassroots of Irish racing, particularly Irish jump racing, with tremendously popular Thursday cards throughout the winter. Thurles is a track that was renowned for being able to race in even the wettest conditions, something so that some people called it Ireland's first all-weather track. But Riona Maloney, who along with her family owns the racecourse, announced on Saturday that it would be closing. She cited among the reasons why the ever-increasing industry demands and the cost of doing business. It underlines the precarious nature that a number of racecourses exist in. Thurles last year lost 3 meetings due to dry conditions, so it hasn't got a watering system. And one suggestion over the weekend, one reason why the decision had been taken to close the track, would be that the cost of introducing a watering system and other things that are in part of a new racecourse manual that's been introduced by IHRB and HRI. IHRB said on Sunday that they didn't believe that there was any reason why that should have forced the closure of Thurles. HRI will now talk to the Maloneys with a view to perhaps trying to save the racecourse as a racing concern. But I think it does highlight the precarious nature that some racecourses exist in. There's a misguided view among some people in racing, some racing participants, that all racecourses are making a fortune, when the reality, as I put in my column in today's Racing Post and available digitally, is that racecourses exist across a wide profitability and affluence spectrum. While some are doing very well indeed, for others, life is hard, and it maybe only takes a bit of bad news to make those racecourses very vulnerable indeed. In Britain, that is only going to be exacerbated by the threat of the racing tax, which the sport is fighting hard on. And also, as I put in my column, there is a major issue hitting the sport, and will hit it even harder, in relation to falling foal crops in Britain and Ireland. And inevitably, that is going to mean there are less horses available to run in races, which would logically require a cut in the fixture list, which would logically therefore mean a fall in levy and media rights income, which would be very damaging to racecourses, some of which are already, as I say, not at all making handsome returns. So, Lewis, first of all, the loss of Thurles, the first Irish racecourse to go since 2008. Neither you nor I have ever been there. I won't pretend to know it, but I've watched plenty of racing from Thurles. And it's always very sad when you lose a racecourse. They're a valuable footprint for the sport across communities in Britain and Ireland, and you really feel it when one goes.
Yeah, it's particularly sad because it sounds like it's a course that's been part of the fabric of Irish jump racing for literally centuries, and that's what makes it really sad. The irony is, it seems like it could take any amount of rain, yet it seems to be a drought over the past winter that has really cost it sort of valuable fixtures and the income that comes with that, and that seems to have played at least some part of the closure. Reading about this, there was a quote from Michael Lowry, a prominent politician who seems to be quite close to the Maloney family who own the course, and he said sort of regulatory rules, expectation, demands and compliance issues have placed a huge burden of pressure, stress and strain on the owners. But why not speak to HRI first to express the financial pressure they were under? I mean, there just seems to be... there was no indication that this was even being discussed, never mind a decision was imminent. And the outpouring of emotion and disbelief really shows that people may have been willing to help. So back of mine, I can't help feeling, is there a bit more to this? At this time, this moment in time, we've got to respect the family's decision. But it just... seems strange that it's come completely out of the blue like this. And it would, I just wish that maybe they'd have expressed this to HRI, and they could have maybe, now HRI have got to go, are going to go and talk to them without seemingly knowing that this was even about to happen. So it's bitterly disappointing. It hasn't been sold for another use as yet. No. So there is hope, and like I say, it seems to play such a big part in the, down in the south there, that for schooling and the fact they can race on desperate ground in the winter means it's something that I'm sure everyone in Irish racing would love to save. So we'll have to watch this space. But I think whether it's in Ireland or Britain, without a portfolio of tracks to spread the cost and the risk, these smaller tracks, these independent tracks, are always going to be under more pressure.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Matt. If you look at tracks within, say, the Jockey Club Racecourses portfolio, the Arena Racing Company, or the HRI-owned tracks in Ireland, there's the opportunity for the smaller, less profitable tracks to, you might say, subsidise, you might say, be supported by the bigger tracks. Certainly it's well known that within the JC portfolio that Cheltenham and Aintree, the profits made there are used not just to maintain Cheltenham and Aintree, but the money's pumped in around the business. There were suggestions, clear suggestions, that when Jim Mullen was brought in as chief executive of the Jockey Club, that he would be looking at that whole race course portfolio and making decisions or recommendations to the stewards of the Jockey Club as to whether the long-term viability and profitability and health of the Jockey Club is best served by maintaining all those race courses. You look at some smaller tracks, and without that protection of a wider group, they are vulnerable. And there has to be a fear, Matt, that we're losing Thurles, maybe will be saved, but it looks like we're losing Thurles at the minute, that it might not be the only one to go in the coming years.
Yeah, I guess it was just a massive reality check in terms of the clouds that are hanging over the sport. You know, from my perspective in Britain, you know, I wasn't expecting news that Thurles was going to go, and it's just really, really sad. Obviously, they've been through a really tough season, obviously, with Michael O'Sullivan, you know, dying of the injuries he sustained at a fall at the track earlier this year. But on the face of it, I always thought Thurles looked like one of the smaller tracks that attracted the really classier horses. You know, Alaho's, Don Cossack's, Under So, I think, made his chasing debut there as well. And it just gave me a sort of a strong reality check that in Britain, a lot of those smaller tracks don't have the quality to attract those type of horses, those caliber of horses, and it does make you really worried about, you know, could this just open up a can of worms in Britain as well in terms of what tracks could be going here? As you said, the racing tax, you've got affordability checks, levy reform, all sort of dark clouds circling over. And it does sometimes feel, you know, with the product we've got over in Britain as well, that it's incredibly diluted at the moment, that it's just completely unsustainable to keep it where it is. So it's just very, very sad. I really do hope they can save Thurles, because you said it was an absolute staple of racing during the winter. And with the horses they attract as well, you know, they get top-class stars there, whereas some tracks in Britain that are smaller do not. And I would be fearing for them now on the back of the news at Thurles, even though it's in Ireland in two different jurisdictions. But they're two jurisdictions going through very similar headwinds and problems at the same time.
Absolutely. Lewis, actually the future viability of racecourses and issues regarding the fog cup and the racing tax, which you mentioned there, they are the sort of things that you would hope a strong and decisive BHA chair would be considering. And we will now have a BHA chair in September. On Monday evening last week, it was announced that Lord Allen, Charles Allen, would be taking up the role of BHA chair, which he was first hired to do in November last year. He was supposed to start in June. That didn't happen. He will now start in September after a BHA bull meeting on Monday resulted in agreement from stakeholders that will move towards the fully independent board that Charles Allen had been insisting upon. He'd also been calling for a separation of the BHA into two different organisations, one focused on regulation, one on commercial matters. That isn't now going forward. It wasn't referenced in the announcement on Monday, but evidently that's a red line that he's been prepared to overlook. The key thing seemed to be independence of the board. It looks like he's achieved that. Fascinating development, important development, but I suppose now the job is creating, finding a fully independent board.
Yeah, it takes us out of a state of limbo first and foremost, which is positive, allows us to progress. But as you say, the big question now is, what does a fully independent BHA board look like? The BHA said it will include experienced individuals from the industry, but is anyone who's worked in the industry for years fully independent? And that's a fascinating angle to this, because you can always go back to someone's history and think and look at what they've achieved, and at some stage I'm sure they'll have been more aligned to one set of stakeholders than another, and I can see that causing an issue with the formulation of this independent board. It's the right process. It's something we should strive to achieve, but when you're looking within the sport, it's hard to find anyone, I would say, that could be judged to be fully independent.
It'll be difficult, but on the positive side, I was speaking to people, Goodwood industry leaders, past and present, and they were saying it is a hard job, and you need a strong and decisive chair, which they said that Charles Allen will be. And they also said if you look back through time, you've had people like Bill Farnsworth and Mark Johnson on the board of the governing body. Yeah. And people I spoke to singled out those two as examples of people who, although they come from the racecourse and the participant sector, were very good at, when they went through the BHA board doors into the room, of taking off those hats and working as representatives of the BHA board. So I think it is doable, but you've got to find the right people.
Yeah, yeah, and that can't be a quick process, though, can it?
No.
And
we can't afford it to be a long process either.
This is it. So it's fascinating how it will play out. I think the proposal to split from into the regulatory on one side and the commercial not being taken up is another thing that on paper seemed like a sensible idea, and there's not been much comment on this, has there? It just wasn't referenced, so we all think, oh, this has been kicked into the long grass. But I'd like to hear a bit more on exactly why we couldn't go forward with that thing. But what I would say is, having a respected Labour peer on our side, especially as Treasury plans to harmonise online gambling tax, is a big win for racing. Albeit we could have done with it about a month ago.
Yeah, we could. Matt, one of the things that people said to me when I was working on a piece, like an Inside the Story piece on the Charles Allen situation, was that point that Lewis makes about a Labour peer, having him in as chair was particularly important, because there has been, since the last election, given the size of the Labour majority, a widespread belief that it'll be a two-term Labour government. Although if you look at the betting on the next general election, it's far from impossible that Nigel Farage could end up as Prime Minister. And Farage was at Goodwood last week and talking in support of racing and the sport's efforts to persuade the government against introducing changes to gambling taxation, which would be potentially horrifically damaging to British racing.
Yeah, it would do, but I would say at this stage it's far more important that we've got a Labour peer in charge of the sport in terms of lobbying purposes. Mr Farage probably needs to turn up to Parliament a little bit more if he wants his view on the racing tax to be effective in that way. So I think it's really, really a big positive. We've finally got a Labour peer in charge in the sport, as you touched on already. Hopefully it's not too late in that way, not going when the stable door is bolted, because there's some big things that we're going to need to be lobbying the government for in terms of the racing tax and affordability. And I think we need to throw our weight behind Lord Allen to say to him, look, this is how dire the consequences could be, especially the racing tax. Because you say the two-term things, it's not just going to go away. So we need it, and we need someone from Labour's side, sort of on the sports side in a way, a bit more than maybe we think. It's good that though so many politicians from Labour's side have been speaking out, but the ones with the real power are the ones that are in charge, which obviously is the Labour government at this stage.
Indeed. And if Charles Allen's appointment or confirmation in the role was a welcome piece of news at the start of last week, there was desperately sad news with the announcement of the death of Edward O'Grady, great Irish trainer at the age of 75. Lewis, he was someone who was a tremendous success over many decades. He was integral to the revival of Ireland's fortunes in the 70s and early 80s at the Cheltenham Festival. He was integral to getting JP McManus more heavily involved in the sport, with early success for JP with Edward O'Grady trained horses. You were saying before we came in, you've got particularly fond memories of one Supreme Novices hurdle in which Edward was involved.
Yeah, back in 2003, when back in front won the Supreme, I remember one of my first festivals and just the buzz around this horse of the Irish banker in the opener. Probably a bit sceptical myself, but crikey, he put 10 lengths between himself and Kicking King that day, and it blew me away, to be honest. I thought, how many champion hurdles is this horse going to win? He unfortunately didn't go on to do that, but I think Edward O'Grady was it's a great career, but he's, from what I could see, he was a great target trainer. The weight of a nation on his back in that race in particular, and he didn't let them down. And as I was back in front, actually, he ran in the same year's Punch Pound Festival. He ran twice in 4 days. He won the Grade One Novice over 2 miles, and then he ran in the Champion Hurdle and came second a few days later. So they're the fond memories. I think effectively he was the Mullins or Elliot of his day, wasn't he? He had an unbelievable record. Like you say, he was the Irish trainer who could be trusted at Cheltenham. He had many winners there. And you read some of the comments and it says a lot about the man. He sounds like he was genuinely sort of a good guy to work for, good to his staff, and universally liked.
Yeah, I'm sure that's all true. If there are two horses maybe he's most remembered for, they'd be Golden Signet, who was set to be arguably the greatest hurdler of all time until his life was tragically cut short in a Scottish champion hurdle, and Gay Future. And I should get a little anecdote of my own here. So this time last year, I was working on a piece to mark the 50th anniversary of the Gay Future coup on the August bank holiday meeting at Cartmel in 1974. And as anyone who has seen the film that was made of that, in which Edward O'Grady was played by Piers Brosnan, Edward was the man who brought Gay Future to Cartmel, prepared flawlessly, won this race, which landed this monumental gamble. Ever since then, Edward had declined to talk about that particular episode in his life, but I thought I'd put in a call to him, send a message actually this time last year, to ask if he might be prepared to break his silence and talk about the coup on its 50th anniversary. He sent me back a very sweet message that said, maybe for the 100th anniversary, if I remember, I'll certainly do it. So a very witty man, as well as a great trainer, and we send our condolences to all Edward's family and loved ones. That then was this week's edition of The Front Page. Matt, briefly, so you're off to see the Quins this week. What else has your week got in store?
Just that really. It's all gearing up now to the Ebor in 2 weeks' time, which I'm starting to feel more like Cheltenham Festival. It's that exciting up here for all of us. So yeah, building up to that really. Really looking forward to going to see John and Sean this week for hopefully a wonderful interview, especially after their big winner last week at Goodwood.
Perfect. And Lewis, you're about to finish off a feature on Midland.
Yeah, life in Midland, coming soon to the Racing Post. Spent a day up there, seeing how it all works on the gallops, the trainers, talking about them. It feels like a positive time for Midland right now. Burke absolutely flying. Group one yesterday, and it's very much along those themes, just a training centre on the up.
Perfect. And I can assure you, we're not only writing about Yorkshire, we've got many other things coming up, including this week, a series on international races and race meetings that you might not have heard of or visited before, but you might wish to in the future. So keep your eyes peeled for that. Enjoy your week. We will be back next week. Until then, thanks for watching. Bye-bye.